want to start with this basic question, and a lot of you are sitting here maybe because you already feel this or answer this question, but I want to do it anyway. Essentially asking the question of why church history? What does this have to offer us? Why should we bother with this? It's not the kind of thing we spend a lot of time talking about in church, really. We don't preach it from the stage necessarily. So is it something that really matters? And I think it kind of does. And I want to give you a few reasons, and just for the record, if you have a handout there, make sure you fill it out fully because you can't leave the room if it's not completed. Brandon will be checking all your papers. Do whatever you want with it. Just don't take notes that are basically doodles like Josue, right? I don't know what to do. Do whatever you want. You can write something. I just wanted to give you something you can follow along if you'd like to. No pressure at all. So I want to give you a few reasons why I believe that church history can be really beneficial. And maybe this class is just a small taste that interests you and you start looking more research. First thing is this. Church history gives us an understanding and knowledge of what we believe in practice. And what I mean by that is everything that we teach today, everything we talk about, all the beliefs that we say that we have, and everything that we do, the practices, the things that we do as a church community, sometimes we have this perception like, well, it all just sort of appeared. It didn't. It was 2,000 years of Christians wrestling and arguing and trying to figure things out that have brought us this place. We have a rich and deep history of insight, and questioning, and searching, and making mistakes, and arguing sometimes to the point of killing each other. And it's all brought us to this place. And so studying church history gives us a better understanding of why we believe what we believe and why we do the things we do. It gives us perspective and awareness of what brought us here. You know, we often hear people make arguments about God. And church practice things, and it can seem like new things are happening, like new things. And there's a verse in the Bible that I love in Ecclesiastes. It says, there's nothing new under the sun. You heard that? In some ways, we need to remind ourselves. Even today, we live in America, it's like all this crazy stuff. And yeah, the internet is quote unquote new. But the way that people behave, the things they do, the problems we face really aren't that new. And the things that we're dealing with even today in America in 2022 are very similar to things they were dealing with 2,000 years ago. So we can look and say, how did they handle it? How did they get through it? So it can illuminate the past and help us make sense of where we're at today. The other thing I would say is church history can give us faith because when you are dealing with a tough situation, things are bleak. And I know we talk about it a lot, but welcome to, I don't know, the world in 2022. It's like, oh, everything's falling apart. It's gonna all, Sometimes just stepping back and being like, actually, it's way worse than that. Or, well, they went through that. It can give us this sense of like, well, what did God do then? Oh, wow, that God did that. Sometimes just looking back gives us this sense that God has brought all these people through it. He's going to bring us through it. And so church history, for me especially, as I've studied it more, it's given me peace in my life at times. When things get chaotic, I'm like, yeah, I remember I read about the 8th century or, you know, the fall of Rome, Christians living there. That was worse than this, and they survived, you know. So it can help you with faith. The other thing I think is important, and this is a big one. Sorry, wrong direction. I think that it should give us humility. And what I mean by that is sometimes as Christians, it can be like, whoa, we're Christians. We got all together. Just because looking at our past can be like, oh, we did that? They did what? Why did they do that? And this humility, the acknowledging that the church has sometimes made mistakes. The church hasn't always got it right. Christians have sometimes done things that, I don't know, this class probably won't get into like the Crusades, but slavery, there's a lot of stuff that the church was involved in its past. But even in the arguments and wars that were fought over religious ideas where people were literally killing each other by the hundreds of thousands. And sometimes understanding our history should give us some humility. Humility to recognize that as Christians, we're not perfect, right? We're not, you know, we can make mistakes. And to walk with grace and humility with the world around us. To know that we do have a history. Sometimes we have to accept it. And I also think thinking about knowing the mistakes that people made in the past, there's a great line that says, people who don't learn and study the past are destined to repeat it. And part of the humility of church history is, what mistakes did they make? Am I humble enough to look at their mistakes and say, are we doing the same thing all over again? Because the reality is, we kind of are. I'll probably get that more in July, but a lot of things you see happening in America today, it happened a couple of times already in church history, and it never ended well. So humility lets us learn from it. And then maybe the most important thing for me is I believe it gives us wisdom in dealing with things in our world. Learning from our past, when interacting and responding to what is an ever-changing culture, the quote-unquote new ideas that we think some people have oftentimes really aren't that new. They're just sort of repackaged and regurgitated things that we've heard many times in history. The ancient church faced serious challenges from science and politics and economics, from philosophy, attacks against its truth and its relevance. Sometimes they'd be like, oh, the church today is, people are atheists are coming at it and trying to attack it. Like, they've been doing that for 2,000 years. What are we talking about here? You know, we talk about, oh, we're faced with a culture that has this sexual ethic we don't agree with. They used to be in a city that you would literally go to a temple and have sex with a prostitute in order to worship a foreign god, right? That was where Christianity was born. And we're today like, oh, the world is so evil, we're going to die. They've dealt with things, politics, rise of nationalism, of empires, entertainment. Oh, entertainment's so gross. I don't think you can even imagine living in Rome 2,000 years ago when we talk about what we think is gross. How do they respond? Disagreements, tensions with themselves, Christians fighting each other. Oh, Christians are so divided today. Open a history book. It's not a new thing. But they've also overcome it, right? They've found ways through it, and so can we. And so wisdom helps us think through things. How do we know if something is just a passing fad? How do we know if we should, you know, a big idea today is like, well, culture is sort of telling us we should stop believing this and go with culture. It's always been doing that. And it can feel sometimes that we get caught in the moment. We're swept up by, oh, culture, oh, it's new. It's like, sometimes church history can let us step back and be like, this has been going on for 2 millennia. We'll survive that. We'll survive this with God's grace. Every question that you have ever asked about the Bible has been asked before. There's not a single question you'll ask the Bible that someone in the last 2,000 years has. Doesn't mean we all have the answers, but it means sometimes just looking at history can help us so much. Give us knowledge, faith, humility, and wisdom. It matters for us. Also, I'm a history nerd, and I just think it's fun. I don't know why. That freaks some people out. But fun. I really do. I just enjoy it. I watch the History Channel when I used to have cable. I like it. It's fun. I like to know the past. And so, yeah, I kind of nerd out into this class. And whatever. You're in here. You chose. There's no one forced to be here, so welcome. So let's dive in. Church history. I want to start by a verse in Galatians 4 says this. It says, when the fullness of time had come, God sent his son. And that's such a cool phrase that Paul says, because we believe that the church started at just the right time. If you think about it, and again, just understanding the world of the day, it's really amazing that human history was leading up to this one moment when the conditions were just right for God to send his son. Right at this place in the Middle East in the Roman Empire in what is now the first century because of the church. So it took place among a group of devoutly religious people who had very specific and peculiar beliefs that were very different from the world around them called the Jews. And they believed in one God, Yahweh. And they believed that the one God, Yahweh, had called them to be a light to the world. And that although they were oppressed, they were dominated by the Roman Empire, God was going to send a king, a Messiah, or Christ, all kind of same word, to lead them and free them and establish his kingdom on earth. And so they're waiting for this. They've been waiting for 4 centuries. Rome and Greece, all other powers had come and gone. And part of their oppression, part of what was difficult is, when different empires had come and conquered their land, because their land was a very important trade route, it was an important route to move military people up from Africa into Asia Minor, and it was very rich in good soil, so the whole area of modern-day Palestine and Israel was constantly fought over, and especially the centuries leading up, you had the Greek Empire who took it over, and the Romans came and took it over, and they're all dominating it, and all the way going back to Babylon 5 centuries before that, every time a power came, the common thing they did is they take some of the people and take them to different places. This is what all powers did in the ancient world. When they conquered, they would divide the people up. because it spread people out and it made it harder to rebel. It was a way to control. What's interesting about that, you think, okay, no big deal. What that meant was, over the previous 5 centuries, these groups of people known as the Jews, who were in a small little country in the middle of nowhere, had been spread out all over the world. And so every major and minor city in the entire known world of the day had Jewish people. What that meant is you could go anywhere in the world in the first century and find somebody who was ready to hear about the Messiah. 3 centuries before, you couldn't go anywhere. you go to Turkey, what Messiah are you talking about? And so we knew this whole study of the book of Acts, right? And Paul and his friends start going missionary journeys, and every time they go to a different city, the first thing they do is they go find the Jewish people, because the Jews had been spread. So it was just the right time. And they called this the diaspora. It's just a word that means kind of spread out. So the Jewish people, because of persecution, because of other people, were spread out, and there were pockets of people all over the world ready to hear the Messiah had come. Furthermore, while Greece and Rome had a lot of, especially Rome, just things that didn't necessarily bring that were good, a lot of difficulty, especially a Jewish person. The truth was, these empires also did some good things. They brought some stability. They definitely brought some safety for the general populace, and they built roads, lots and lots of roads. And what this meant is, it's so hard for you to think about this in our world today. But back then, if you lived in a small little hamlet in the middle of nowhere, you probably were born there, grew up there, married someone there, spent your whole life there, and died there and rarely ever left. Because it was very difficult to travel. What Rome and Greece did was they built these thoroughfares and highways that connected the entire empire. So for the first time in human history, you could actually leave your home and be somewhere 600 miles away in a relatively decent amount of time in pretty much safety. So what it meant, it encouraged travel. People began to spread out. People began to go and trade, and economics started to move and spread because of the safety. So for the first time in human history, you had the ability for an idea or a concept to actually spread beyond its smaller borders. That's when Jesus came. And of course, when Alexander the Great started to conquer, his vision was, I want to make everybody Greek like me, because he believed the Greeks were the pinnacle of human civilization. Again, everything just keeps repeating itself, Hitler, so whatever. And so what Alexander did was, whenever he conquered a country, he would force all the people to learn his language, which sucks, he didn't force it on me. But here's the thing, 300 years later, most of the known world all spoke a similar language, which today, you think about it, you can go anywhere in the U.S., right, pretty easily. You can jump on a plane, you can call anyone, and you can go anywhere in our country and talk to anyone. They understand you, and you get there pretty easily. That never existed until then. So if Jesus had come 2 or 3 centuries earlier, this little group of people would never have been able to travel. Had they traveled anywhere, it would have been safe, and it wouldn't have been safe, and they couldn't have talked to anyone when they got there. They would have spoken Arabic and gone to their country, and turned around. But at this point in human history, they could travel safely, move around, and everywhere they went, they could find people they could talk to, and they could find pockets of Jews to start. So missionary movements and people just moving out of their homes to go to new places for economic reasons, for trade, for commerce, all of this is beginning to boom, and that's the moment that it comes. And then the last thing is this. What we can see in a lot of literature from this time is, I put it this way. People were growing dissatisfied with what we call the old gods. And what I mean by that is, because of all this travel, all the opening of new worlds, of people meeting each other, of cultures coming together, of ideas being spread, the Greeks were big on philosophy and thinking. What you had were a lot of people who were open to new ideas. Now in America, we are a culture that is naturally open to new ideas. It's part of who we are. It was not the ancient world. In the ancient world, new things were frowned upon. New things were bad. New religions were bad. They were illegal in the Roman Empire. What made something good was how old was it. So if you could prove you had ancient roots, and there's a history that you were respected, new things were bad. This was beginning to change for the first time in recorded history, with the Greeks and now the Romans. So new ideas, people are like, I am interested in new ideas. And this is the moment the Apostle Paul starts to go to all these places and say, I've got some new ideas. Really, tell us about them. So I want to say this because God knew exactly when to send Jesus. The start of the church happened at the perfect moment in human history for it to be actually able to spread and for people to begin to hear it, for the ideas to move beyond smaller borders. It was the perfect time. And that's cool, just thinking the way God works, right? This made the first century in the Roman Empire the perfect time for the Messiah to arrive. And starting in the early 40s, a few years after Jesus, you have this group of Jews who start declaring their Messiah has come, and they begin traveling out and moving around and spreading and starting this movement that would, within a couple centuries, dominate the known world, which is incredible. It never would have happened before this because of this moment. And we'll also see the whole area, the whole known world at the time outside of Eastern Asia was dominated by the Roman Empire. What would happen if the Roman Empire actually became Christian? We'll see that next week. So you're right at the right moment. So that's the setting. That's the groundwork for this whole movement to begin. And then what I want to do is I want to look at a few events, but also kind of just general life. The first thing I want to talk about is, while this is forming in the first 20 years, people are, you know, it's a smaller group. They're hanging out mostly kind of around Israel, Jerusalem area. They're mostly Jewish people. Paul and some others will kind of go on missionary journeys and meet a few people here and there. For the most part, it's all taking place centrally in this Jerusalem area. Everything begins to change with one massive event, and it was a huge event. In AD 70, so you're talking, you know, somewhere about 30, 35 years now since Jesus, the city of Jerusalem falls. And what happens here is there's a long history of Jewish people hating Rome and believing that they're the devil and they're pagans, and that God's promises to them were that they would throw off Roman oppression and establish God's kingdom in the city. And this actually is a belief that they held for a long time. And in 66 AD, so 4 years prior, you had a group of Jewish people, zealots, who were like, we believe that now's our time. They had a guy named Simon Bar Kokhba that they believed was their Messiah. They called him the Messiah. They printed coins and put his face on it. They called it year one of God's kingdom. They rallied all of their troops, and they actually kicked out all the Romans out of Jerusalem. And they celebrated, this is the day we've won our freedom. And then the Roman emperor heard about it and said, nope. Emperor Nero sent his general Vespasian down to send his whole army to modern-day Palestine. And over the next 4 years, they essentially wiped it out, killed hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, sacked the city, destroyed it, destroyed the temple where they worshiped, just completely demolished everything. And they were going after Jews and Christians because at the time, the Roman Empire saw them as the same. And what's important for you to understand is at that point in Jewish history, about 70 AD, they were the same. They still were. If you went back in time and you talked to people in 66 AD, and you talked to a Christian, they wouldn't have called themselves a Christian. That word didn't even exist to them. They were Jewish followers of the way. They were Jews who believed that their Messiah had come. And they were arguing with other Jews who didn't believe their Messiah had come. It wasn't a different religion, right? It wasn't a different group of people. It was the same group of people who had a slightly different viewpoint. But in AD 70, everything starts to really change. So you have here, as tensions are mounting up, the Christians, for the most part, and this is, I'm going to give you some opinion here. If you know your Bible, Matthew 25 is a famous, Jesus gives a whole statement about in the end times and destruction and fleeing to the hills. There's disagreement among scholars about whether Jesus is talking about like a literal end time, like the future, or was he actually talking about AD 70? I can't answer that question, but I can tell you historically, the early church did not think it was end times the way a lot of dispensationalists do, which is a discussion that Revelation is going to be having. The early church believed Jesus was talking about this. So when Rome started marching on Jerusalem, Christians left because they remembered their Messiah saying, when this happens, run away, don't fight. They were pacifists. They weren't going to leave. So Christians left the city. Two things. That means in AD 70, when hundreds of thousands of Jews were slaughtered, most of them weren't Christians. The Christians weren't there. And secondly, it meant they spread out. Right? Where are you going to go? Our home's destroyed. I don't know. Let's move to Corinth and build a home there. So because of this moment, Christianity really began to spread because they had to leave. It was like, in a sense, it was almost like the teenager got kicked out of their parents' basement and it's time to go live your own life. And there had been a lot of tension with the Jews. And at this point, it really came to a head because the Christians wanted to separate themselves from the Jewish people. They'd be like, we're not Jews. We're not fighting against you. Rome, we're not trying to kill you. And the Jewish people actually wanted to blame Christians. A lot going on there. But essentially, In 87, you really see a break completely. And the writing after that, by the early part of the next century, Christianity has become a kind of its own thing, and it's different and distinct from Jews. Also, as the movement moves out, the people that Paul and others are preaching to, and all these Jewish people spreading and leaving, they're starting to look less and less Jewish, and they're sharing their faith with Gentiles who aren't Jewish at all. And it doesn't take very long for Christianity to actually become kind of a Gentile thing. There's more non-Jews than there are Jews, probably within the next 20 or 30 years after this. So the whole movement begins to shift and change. And so this is a major, major impact for them. So while Paul and his friends, they're already taking kind of missionary journeys around the area, you now have this mass exodus, like people leaving California, right? And they start to spread out, right, this little space here. Within the next 20 years, you have Christians all over the known world. And Paul himself makes it all the way to Rome, where he spends the rest of his life and dies. And so very quickly, this spreads and moves around. And we'll see that this kind of becomes the end of a sort of, the tense Jew-Christian relationship breaks really badly, and they almost become adversaries. But it's a major turning point. So Christianity is now no longer a form of Judaism or the Jewish religion. It's its own thing. But it's very young. It's very young. The person who started it, Jesus, is gone, right? And it's like you got this little fledgling movement that's just blowing up, and there's all these people. Yeah, we're in. And it's like, wow, what do we do with it? And suddenly they're faced with all these challenges and trouble. How would they work through it? How would they establish what is true, what isn't true? How would they make sure that we're doing the right things and we're still following Jesus? We're now taking center stage in the world, like the emperor knows who we are. We're not this little group of people in the middle of nowhere. So what we're going to see then over these first few centuries is Christianity has to kind of grow up really quick and address some of these big problems. It has to figure out what it is and how it's going to, what kind of movement it's going to be. Will it be true to Jesus' message? So we're going to see that a lot as we see. So I want to look at a couple things in terms of this. First is, before we get into some of those things, I just want to look at, if you are a Christian living this time in history, say you're in the second century, it's 110 AD, Jesus has been gone for about 80 years, your grandparents knew him but they're dead, you're a third generation Christian, what does life look like for you? And I think that's important for us to just kind of get a picture of their world and their life. So life in the early church. The first thing I want to say is this. When we talk about Christians at the beginning, Christians almost universally, from every piece of writing that we have, and we don't have any writings from Christians in the first century other than the Bible. Our first Christian writings come early second century, about 109, 110, somewhere there. But we have a lot of writings from non-Christians, from Romans and others, philosophers, writing about Christianity. The one thing we see again and again is that when they talked about Christians, it was never positive, ever. Now, sometimes we think we have a very victim mentality. We're like, oh, it's persecution. It wasn't so much persecution. It was more just straight up stupidity. So the general thing about Christians in the beginning was that, what we know is it was generally a poor, uneducated, lower class. Christianity was often described by its critics as a religion for slaves and women. Like educated people with any means, if you have any money, you're not a Christian. Christians is what our slaves do. Christians and women, you know, women were subclass. They were beneath men. So saying it's for slaves, poor people, women was basically like, this isn't for people that we care about. Which actually kind of makes sense. You know, Paul speaks about in Corinthians the wisdom of the world shaming the wise. This is what he's saying. He's speaking to people like Christians. Those are all illiterate idiots. He's like, yeah, but God used those illiterate idiots to shame you, educated rich people. There was no political power. They didn't have any. There wasn't a lot of wealth among Christians. Very rare. There were simpletons. They were country bumpkins, which makes perfect sense when you consider this. Their king was a suffering, crucified Messiah who acted like a slave. You've taken my Rise to Life class. It's a big part of it. The king that they followed washed people's feet on purpose. He spoke mercy and blessing to the poor and the brokenhearted. He called people to die to themselves. He told people, don't seek power and political glory. Lay your life down. So, of course, these are the people who he's drawing. And maybe the rich and powerful people chose to look like this, right? They appeared to be less than they were many times because they were following Jesus. He taught about his whole idea of religion was loving people and laying your life down. And so it spread most among Christians who chose that lifestyle or are you living that lifestyle. When you want to share your faith with somebody and your faith is that God loves the poor and the lowly, it is the poor and the lowly that you're going to and talking to. When God says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to give your life away to serve people in need. You start serving people in need and suddenly the people in need become the Christian community. There was no power among the early church. We're going to see probably next week that power didn't creep in for a few centuries. It was the poor and the lowly. And secondly, when we talk about churches, churches, the word church just meant a gathering of people. And essentially, the word church was usually applied to a city or a town. Paul said the church in Corinth, the church in Rome. That didn't mean there was like one central location. He was just speaking to all the Christians. What they usually did was they would all, there'd be maybe many Christians in big cities, but they would gather in what you and I today would call small groups, but for them that was church. An average church probably had about 12 to 15 people at the most. They would meet in two places commonly. The most common one was a home. But even when we say a home, one thing you gotta consider is if there were 15 people in church, only one of those people owned a home, right? Very rarely did somebody have a household big enough to host a group of people. So if maybe a richer, higher class person actually became a convert, often be like, hey, will you host a church? Right? We need a place to stay. The poor people often sometimes meet in the streets. The common one was also in catacombs or where you bury dead. They did that for two reasons. Number one, early on, Christians weren't allowed to buy property. So if you already owned property, you converted, you kept it. But if you were a Christian, you couldn't go and buy more. And usually you were poor and couldn't anyway. But they also had a belief that there was this sort of, they believed in the resurrection. There was almost like a commiseration with death. And they often chose catacombs as a place to worship, mostly because they could. They'd be left alone. This game, of course, very, you know, other people were like, what's with these people beating tombs, right? Kind of raise your eyebrow. These churches would be started by the apostles, who would then leave and turn it over to someone to run. Who do you turn it over to run? Nobody has a seminary degree. Hey, you became a Christian yesterday. You're in charge. I am. So if you look at Paul's writings, he actually gives lists of things that you need to be qualified to lead a church. And if you notice what he says, sometimes we read them today and we don't understand the context. He's like, you need to be able to read and teach and manage your household okay. And we read those things today and it's like, I have to have a seminary degree. No, he just meant you need to be literally be able to read. Because literacy was about 3% in the ancient world. That means if you had 100 people, only 3 of them could read a book. And nobody had books. Books were crazy expensive. They weren't a literate culture. So if you had someone that was wealthy enough to own a home, they probably had some understanding of being able to read. Most often than not, though, if you notice, what Paul would do is he'd write his letters and he'd send them with somebody who could read. That person would go to church, house to house, and read it to the people. And if there was someone that could read, maybe they'd copy it and have a copy, and that person would read it. So Paul says, okay, you're in charge if you can kind of manage things, if you have a space for people, and you can teach these scriptures to people. That's sort of the base examples of what we needed. Because again, you're talking about poor people, lonely people, very few rich people, and very few people who actually had means to read things. Then we talk about what they actually did. When we talk about worship, for us, worship is we come in this building, we sit in a chair, somebody sings a song, we sing along, then we preach at you. There's some similarities there, but they did sing hymns. They would pray together. The central, most important thing they did, though, when they talked about worship, was what is often today called communion or the Lord's Supper. Now, just to be clear, when you and I talk about communion, it's kind of always the same thing. There's a little cup, a little piece of bread up the front, you walk in, and you take it. That's not what they meant by Lord's Supper. That's communion, the word Eucharist or new or good meal. This literally was supper. Like, they're talking about a meal here. You see this in Corinthians. They're talking about a meal. Why is that worship? Two reasons. In the ancient world, one of the most important personal things you could do was share a meal with somebody. Sharing a meal was a huge part of relationships. But how and who you shared a meal with spoke everything about your social status, your culture. There were certain people that you did not allow to sit at your table. And even the people you did allow to sit at your table, where you sat at the table mattered. So the head of the household, the most important of the men, from there was down, and the slaves and the poor people, the kids would be out there, the women would be over here, you'd throw them some food, maybe the important men are sitting here. That's supper. That's how you honor each other, right? And the early Christian church started having a meal every week with the head of the household sitting at the table next to his slaves and the women and the children, and the person that actually sits outside of his door and begs for scraps is now sitting at a table with him eating, which is basically shaming him to the world. Like, all of his friends would be like, what on earth are you doing? The Lord's Supper was more than just this like metaphysical, oh, it was a practice of community in the new heaven and new earth, where they're saying all these things that used to separate us are gone, and now we're a new people. We're going to live differently. We're going to be different with each other. We're going to act differently. We're going to do it because that's what Jesus did. So every time they'd meet together once a week, probably it was on Sunday, they would take this ceremonial meal together. They would sing, they would talk, and they would say, we are a different group of people. We are living life differently. What it means to be Christian is we're not going to ostracize each other. The poor aren't going to be over there, and the women aren't going to be over there. We're not going to pick our place on the table based on how rich we are. We're just all going to come and sit together. And they struggled with this. Paul had to address it in his letter to Corinth. Are you guys seriously still separated during your Lord's Supper? Stop, right? You're missing the point. But this was a big part of the word. And of course, they would hear someone teach the word. Again, hear someone. They didn't pull out their Bibles. Nobody had Bibles. They didn't exist. Yeah?
Was this not also a celebration of the fact that the Spirit had moved from the temple into the new temple with their bodies, and they would gather to celebrate the fact that Jesus Christ was there?
Absolutely. And secondly, another thing too, I didn't get this, but I didn't mean to say it wasn't a celebration. It absolutely was a celebration. It was a remembrance, for sure. But what I'm getting at was, it wasn't just about the earliest, this is a side note, the earliest reference we have to a Christian community taking communion to remember the death of Jesus is in the 4th century. Nobody wrote anything in the first 3 centuries about taking communion or Lord's Supper having anything to do with the death of Jesus. It was all about the resurrection of Jesus. It was about the new life and the new community being formed. We first see that with Jerome in the 4th century. Now, that doesn't mean they never did it. And Paul does sort of reference, you know, remember my body broken for you. But it wasn't, when we see their stuff, they were focused on celebrating what God had done to the resurrection. The new community was formed, new life in the Spirit. Yeah, for sure. More than take this to remember Jesus died for me. But that was part of it. Yeah. Yeah. Or somebody who had it memorized. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They lost to us. What were the answers? Yes. We can't actually speak Koine Greek anymore. Nobody speaks it. So we wouldn't even know if we could. It's a good question, though. Maybe we'll find out in heaven. Yeah. There are some hymn words for sure. We believe some of them. We think Paul used some of them. There's arguments that Paul's letter to the Philippians, when he breaks into that, have the same mindset of Jesus, who being the very nature of God. That actually is written like a hymn. There's a few places it looks like Paul's quoting hymns. Yeah, for sure. Okay, we keep moving. So yeah, they would sing. They would talk. An overseer, whoever was in charge, would share the word with them. And it's also note, like, this wasn't really a place for evangelism. Especially by the second, third century, you weren't bringing, this wasn't like, hey, come to my house for dinner and hear about Jesus. They believed this was a time where the Christians would gather together and edify each other. But it doesn't mean they didn't evangelize. They absolutely did. They just took Jesus' word serious in the Great Commission. Hey, you, while you're going, make disciples of all nations. That's what they did. When I'm off working, when I'm over here, I'm telling people about Jesus, right? And so they were constantly sharing their faith with people. And the word of God spread at an unbelievable rate. This raised a lot of questions about what you had to do to actually be a member. How much do you have to look like a Jew was a big deal in the beginning. We'll get back to that in a little bit. Paul wrote a lot about that. And it led to, like, how much do you have to know? How do we teach these people anything? They had something called catechism. You heard that word. We still use it in Lutheranism. The Catholics use it. It just means it's from didactic, to teach or to explain things. New converts had to go through a whole season. By the 3rd century, this was like 8 months long. Before you could get baptized, they had to make sure you knew what you understood what you're talking about and that you were fully committed. So they had this whole process of helping people get connected and grow and move into this. So the church is beginning to figure itself out. It's at this point mostly poor, lower class people. Occasionally they'll have a benefactor with some money. it's just people who are finding joy and life in God despite their circumstances. And that's what's making it spring. And during this time, as it's beginning to grow, it's constantly facing threats, constantly. There are always threats in the early church. It's like just under siege constantly from so many different directions. And to really make sense in the early years, you kind of have to make sense of what they were under threat from, and then also how they responded. So for our last time, for just the rest of our class, I want to look at the things that were threatening the church, and then look at the ways that they responded, because those form the foundation of who we are today. And let me start here. The first threat to the Christians, as I already mentioned, was the Jews. And this is a touchy situation. The Jewish people were extremely devout and serious about their faith, something that I admire. And oftentimes we sort of read our Bibles and the Jews are the bad guys, right? Oh, they're the bad Jews. The Jewish people were the only people on the planet who were actually worshiping the one true God. They weren't the bad guy. They were serious about their faith. And they had people in their own community who often tried to pervert and change things. There were other Jewish sects in S-E-C-T-S. There were other Jewish groups who were breaking off and teaching weird things. And like the core Jewish leaders, that's not right. Stop that, right? Things that you and I would be like, yeah, it isn't right. So when they looked at the Christians, these followers of Jesus, they were like, this is like heresy what you guys are doing here. This isn't real. This isn't right. And it wasn't just because they believed Jesus was the Messiah. Believing Jesus was the Messiah was not heresy. Okay, just to be clear. No Jewish person said that's heresy. Believing Jesus was God was absolutely heresy. And for the record, saying Jesus was the Son of God was not heresy. The phrase Son of God referred to the Messiah. David was the Son of God. When they said Jesus is the Son of God, they weren't saying Jesus is God. When Jesus said before Moses, I am, that was tear your robe, stone this guy, he's a heretic. The Christians worshiped Jesus as God. And the Jewish people were like, there is only one God, have no other gods before him. You are a heretic, do not call yourself a Jew, right? So they fought with them, they pushed them out. Remember what I said about the culture and respecting ancient things. Rome, and we're going to get to Rome in a minute, Rome had a law that they wouldn't recognize new religions. The reason for doing that is, I'll get into it in a second. But the Jewish people had managed, going all the way back to Alexander the Great, Alexander loved the Jewish people. He gave them so much favor. He died, then to go off and under. But going all the way back to Alexander the Great, the Jewish people had a special, my brain's drawing blank. They had they were not held to the standard of other religions that were considered new. They were able to convince the Roman people that their religion was ancient, going all the way to Moses. So essentially Rome said, okay, you can do your thing. We'll give you a pass. Just don't go around spreading your nonsense. We'll let you be though. So the Jewish people could exist as a religion. They could get away with doing things that other people couldn't. And the Jewish people were always fighting and causing trouble. So the Rome was often like, just let you be alone, just stay calm. The Christians weren't. So when the Christians started doing things that were causing trouble, the Jewish people were like, hey, they're not us, they're something else, they're illegal, get rid of them, right? They're right, because the Roman Empire was like, who are these Jews causing all this trouble? And you're like, they're something else, they're not us. So the Jewish people were actually turning in Christians to Roman authorities oftentimes, creating a lot of tension. They were afraid that Christians would bring the wrath of God for heresy, and they were afraid that Christians could bring the wrath of Rome for all their weirdness. So they didn't want to lose their protected status. That's what they were. So the Jewish people were constantly at odds with the Christians. This would create 2,000 years of problems, culminating, World War II. I mean, much of what Hitler did, he justified going all the way back to this. We won't talk about that a lot when we talk about the Reformation, where Jews were definitely painted as a villain. But a lot of trouble would come out of this. Of course, Rome was also an issue. But when I teach church history, this is something I don't want to talk about. We have a verse that we sometimes talk about with our youth. I was taught when I was a student. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God. I was always taught as a kid that I was supposed to not be ashamed or like feel stupid or bad for my faith. I was supposed to stand up for this. Number one, I believe that's true, but that's not what Paul's saying. To be ashamed wasn't what you and I think of as like embarrassed. It meant to have your status lowered in the eyes of other people. he was saying, I'm not lowered in status because of the gospel. You think I am because Jesus looks to you like he was a crucified slave. So you think because I follow him, I'm less, but I'm not. I'm actually going to be glorified with him, and you'll see it one day. That's what he was getting at. But when we talk about Rome, we talk about persecution, we talk about this, we often have this picture in our mind of, like, if some of you were Christians in high school and you were picked on, maybe, like that's what Rome was doing to the Christians, because they're, I'm not going to be ashamed. I want to say, like, that kind of stuff happened, but we're talking about the Roman government. That's not the issue. The Roman government did not look at Christians and be like, oh, that's bad theology, we're going to throw you to lions, okay? They didn't care. There's not a single letter we have. We have a lot of letters. There's not a single place that we see a Roman official being like, these Christians are teaching things that seem heretical. They just don't care. What Rome cared about was control. Rome had a massive empire, and the people that were responsible for the Middle East where this was happening were responsible for peace and stability and making sure things got a hand. So what mattered was that every person swore allegiance to Caesar as Lord, that confessed him as king, and did what he said, right? That's what mattered. The Christians took the Roman sacramentum of swearing faith to Caesar and took it themselves and made their own sacramentum where they swore faith to Lord Jesus, called baptism. And the Romans started hearing about it. The Romans were like, wait, they're swearing allegiance to a different Lord? In Greek, the word Lord, Kurios, they had a phrase, Kaiser, where you get the word Caesar or king. They say, Kaiser as Kurios, Caesar is Lord. And they say, no, Jesus as Kurios, Jesus is Lord. That was a subversive political statement. They believed that Jesus was the rightful king of the world, and therefore Caesar is not. Caesar didn't like that. So when a Christian was brought before a Roman tribunal, it wasn't, you believe heresy, repent. It was, we've heard you've sworn allegiance to a different Lord. Repent or recant of your baptism. Again, it's not religion, people. It's not like ideas or spiritual stuff. It's political loyalty. They were seen as subversive. To recant your baptism was to say, never mind, I'm not loyal to this other Lord. I'm loyal to Caesar only. And Christians would say, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to do it. All right, well, this is what we do to people who won't be loyal to Caesar. Slaves, people we catch when we conquer them, we take them, we drag them to the city, then we throw them to lions. That's what we're going to do to you, because you're not loyal to Caesar. So when Christians were martyred and killed by the Roman Empire, it was almost always an issue of political allegiance, taking the word faith literally as loyalty to a king, not just as I believe some ideas you don't like. And we see this very clearly, especially in a letter from Pliny the Younger to his, he was a Roman prefect, he wrote a letter to his boss. Hey, what do I do when I find one of these Christians who won't swear off his baptism? And I give him an opportunity. I give him a couple days to sweat it off. If they don't, fine, kill him. That's basically, it was a very informal letter. So this is happening. You also have the imperial cult, where they would worship Caesar as a son of a god, a descendant of the gods. And of course, Christians wouldn't do that. And so they were also, even within their own cities, if you were in Corinth, you wanted Rome's favor. You wanted Rome to support you because Rome, the Roman Empire, would give you free stuff. So if you had Christians in your city who wouldn't bow down and worship Caesar when he came through, you're causing trouble for us. Knock it off. If there was any place that religion mattered, it was only in the fact that the Romans and the Greeks believed that keeping the gods happy was keeping their favor. As long as the gods were happy, things would go well for us. These people over here are saying those gods don't even exist and telling us to stop worshiping them, stop. Knock it off. Don't say that. Then Zeus won't give us favor. Right? So it was all politics. It was all power. And then, of course, Nero made it worse by blaming Christians when he started the fire. But I don't know that. And, of course, you had the general public who, again, saw Christians as strange and stupid. They mistrusted Christians. And this shouldn't be a surprise because Jesus said, you're going to be weird. You're going to be mistrusted. Christians acted funny, and they wouldn't engage in normal activities of most citizens. They wouldn't do the things that Roman citizens wanted to do. Again, how the world has changed. They didn't trust him because they didn't want to go and do all their stuff. Christ called for a new kind of lifestyle, stood opposed to how most Romans and Greeks live their lives. Violent games, sensuous living. And that would be gross, but like you're talking about a culture that believed one of the primary ways to worship their deities was orgies, right? Like they were a culture that wrestled in the nude. They were just a very sexual kind of culture. And here's Christianity saying, no, that's not God's intention for us as people. It created tension. They entertain themselves by watching people murder each other in arenas. And the Christians are like, no, we're not going to support that. So they seem like weird outsiders. They also wouldn't worship their gods and do the things they wanted to do that they thought would bring them blessing. And these people were passionate about religion, which was weird. Like Greeks and Romans were like, why are you so worked up about religion? Just, you know, make your sacrifice once a month and it's fine. Don't be all crazy about it. How the world has changed, right? So Christianity is very different. It's unique, and it's against multiple gods. They stayed out of the theater. They wouldn't serve in the army because they didn't believe that Rome should be doing what they do. They wouldn't worship the emperor. Again, if this was the Revelation class, I might teach this, but when the emperor would come into a city, everyone would have to come out of the streets to pay him homage. That's where we actually get the word rapture, parousia, meeting the emperor when he comes. And they would often have to burn incense to the emperor. And there's tradition that says when you would burn, they would put some of the mark on your face to show that you did it. And if you didn't have it, you weren't loyal. And it's even thought that sometimes like people wouldn't sell to you if you didn't have the mark. If, you know, Nero, who's number 666. So there's a lot of stuff here that Revelation is probably referring to about trying to live in this world where it's against you as a Christian. It's difficult. You're constantly being pushed against. Now, just specifically on a side note, when we talk about persecution too, throughout the first few centuries, what we see in the literature that we have is that there's a general policy to oppose Christianity. It's illegal. But it's also kind of like a lot of the stuff we see is like, I don't want to deal with this. You know, like, just keep your mouth shut. I don't want to kill you. I see that there's actually quite a few letters that sound like that. It's not this picture of like, the evil Romans. A lot of times it's like, oh, come on, really? There's a guy named Polycarp, who's one of the most famous martyrs. And there's a whole recording of his conversation with the Roman prefect. And the Roman prefect is like, dude, you seem like a nice guy. I don't want to hurt you. Come on, man, you're an old man. Will you just say you're loyal to Caesar? And Polycarp stands up in front of the crowd. He says, 90 years of my life, Jesus has never let me down. I'm not letting him down now. And he marches into the amphitheater and someone yells, play the band, Polycarp. And he raises his fist and a lion mauls him. That actually wasn't the norm. We can get a picture like people are constantly fed the lions. That wasn't the norm. The most important thing you want to understand is when it came to what we call persecution by the Roman Empire, it was usually the church leader. You'd go after the person in charge. The common Christians, I mean, they weren't grabbing slaves off the street and killing them. They would go after church leaders. And the reason they would go after church leaders, and this is I got time for this, was because Christianity was understood by this time to be highly centered around these writings that they kept reading to each other and talking about. And writings were hard to find and difficult. So there was kind of this general consensus that, well, first of all, if we can get rid of the writings, right, if we can get rid of these scrolls they keep reading by this Paul guy, it'll all go away, right? So like they actually, part of being, if you're a Roman official, the way that you often deal with it is you try to figure out who had the writings, who had these scriptures, who owned them. You'd find it was usually the leader of the church. When they would come to him, they would give him an option. They'd say, we don't want to hurt you for the most part. Just give us the writings. And in Latin, if you were to take your copies of Corinthians and give it to the Roman person, the word was traditores. To hand over, and it's where we get our word traitor. A traitor was somebody who gave away the writings because the writings were all we had. There's one copy in this whole city, and you gave it to him? Well, if I didn't, he was going to kill me. that's tough, right? Was that book actually something you should have died for? Like, well, I will die for the writings. Is the Gospel of Thomas something I should die for? How do you know that, right? So that was going on. It was usually a leader of the church, a bishop or something. They're the ones that faced the most difficulty. But persecution is a real thing. Sometimes it got really bad. Some emperors were way worse than others. Nero was terrible. Domitian was brutal. Trajan, kind of. So different emperors had different opinions. They all kind of, you see kind of ebbs and flows. Some of the worst persecution happened at the end of the third century. And then, of course, in the middle of the second, it's pretty bad. But oftentimes, it wasn't like every day that was happening. There were oftentimes really like peaks and valleys. But it could be really bad. And what we definitely see is when it was worse, the worst moments of church persecution, you go and read it, are often followed by the greatest moments of church outbreak. And I believe it was Tertullian who said, the blood of martyrs is seed for the growth of the gospel. This became such a big problem that Paul had to address it in one of his letters. He was like, hey, guys, like, you know, I love that you're like all passionate, but just dying doesn't do anything, right? He's like, even if you submit your body to the flames, it's nothing if you're not living in love, right? It almost became like a badge of honor to die for your faith. But as long as it's going to happen, it was a difficult season for sure. And a lot of people gave in. What do you do with somebody after they give in if they come back and they're sorry? Do we let them back in? That would be a big issue. Okay, so you had the Jews, Rome, the general public. Then you had within your own community, you have these Jewish converts who are now Christians. And they're fighting with me because they're like, wait a second. If you want in, you've got to be Jewish. You've got to become like us. You can't stop doing, like, we have the law. God told us how to behave. So they were struggling with what to do with all of this stuff they had been taught they were supposed to do for 1,000 years. We covered that a bit in our Acts series. They understood the importance of serving one God. They were on board with that. But they felt I'm supposed to be circumcised. I'm not supposed to eat pork. Like, I can't shave. I mean, the Greeks all shave their faces and wrestle naked. I can't do any of that, right? And then the Christians they're just, you know, pagans who are now Christians. Like, yeah, I have to grow my hair out? You want me to do what? No, right? But there's this tension. And if you understand that tension, and this probably isn't the place to get into it, what you'll find is, and again, I think this sheds some light on when we read the Bible. One of the kind of maybe areas of, I don't want to say mistake, but maybe a blind spot for us as modern Western readers of the Bible is not understanding this, how big of a deal this was. And we'll read Paul's letters a lot of times and confuse or be confused about what he's talking about. The person that did that the most in a way that mostly impacted the world is a guy named Martin Luther. He read Paul's messages about tension between law and grace as something about Catholicism. We're going to get into that in July. But really, a lot of Paul's writings, when he's talking about, you know, this idea of the law and what it meant to be Jewish, especially Romans, Galatians, it's the whole book, he's making a statement about how we now live together. What do we do with the Jewish converts who are now Christians? And what do we do with the Gentiles who are now grafted into, are we still Jews? We're not still Jews. So do you have to be this? Can you be something else? Like, this was a big, big deal. And Paul was a missionary to Gentiles, bringing Gentiles into the family, and he's in the middle of this tension. So it's all over his writings. This attempt to figure out what he should say to the Jews and how we can come be a new community, a new family. So this was a big deal for them. And then, while you had issues with the Jewish people and their history, you had a ton of issues with these pagans who are now becoming Christians. Of course, the biggest one is what we would all understand. We've all, maybe in this room, you have a past. Maybe you didn't grow up in a Christian home and you had a certain lifestyle that you lived, and one day you become convinced that Jesus is truly who he said he was and you want to be a follower. You're like, yeah, I'm going to do that. And they're like, okay, here's the rules. Rules? What? I can't have sex? Like, what are you talking about? Like, what? I can't drink wine. I have to throw my blonde away? What is this? Right? And for a lot of people, that's very difficult. Imagine growing up in Ephesus in the first century, and yesterday you left the temple to Aphrodite, and you slept with a 14-year-old prostitute as a form of worship, and today you become a Christian. And here's this guy, Paul, being like, you got to leave all that behind. You can't do that anymore. I can't? Why not? This tension is difficult. My whole life I've sacrificed to the pagan gods. And being pagan meant I believed in lots of gods. So if you came to me and said, let me tell you about Jesus, God, I'd be like, oh, okay, tell me about him. I know like 50 of them. He's 51, sure. We don't get this as much, but if you go to like India, it's all over India because they have so many gods. If you tell them about Jesus, they're like, all right, one more. And the Christian, no, it's not one more. It's the only one. Like, all those other beings you thought you're worshiping aren't even real. Get rid of all of them. All of it? But, my whole work is, like, dedicated to Aphrodite. My whole family goes there every day. How can I get rid of all that? So as a Christian, you're on both sides of this. You got the Jewish people trying to figure out how to still but not be Jewish, and the pagans who are like, well, I still want this. No, you can't. Like, it's just this massive culture clash. All coming together around a table once a week. This would have been wild. This would have been, can you just imagine how difficult this would be? The challenges they would have faced, the problems they would have come up. If you're Paul, what do? You probably sit down and you're like, oh, people of Corinth. Okay. And you write a whole letter about all the things they're doing wrong. You're like, come on, don't love each other. You stop this. And stop judging each other. And the pagans were like, oh, those stupid Jews. They think they can't eat pork. I can eat pork. I'm a Christian, right? And here's Paul being like, yeah, you can, but you're hurting, you know? He's like, and the Jewish people are like, oh, you really did that? You know, and just, you just imagine this clash of cultures that's happening. And so much of Paul's writing is trying to bring people together. The dividing walls have come down. There's no longer Jew and Gentile, slave or free. We are now, we are one community, and we're gonna sit around this table and love each other. No matter how much money you make, no matter who your parents are, no matter your heritage, Jesus has brought us all together. And what's cool in a weird kind of way is you and I, for the most part, we still have our issues. For the most part, we're kind of like, yeah, well, of course. I don't care who your parents are. I don't care how much money you make. Come to church. Because we've had 2,000 years to try to work it out. And we still don't have it quite where I'd like it. There's a lot of white people in this room. Sorry. I mean, right? We're still struggling a little bit, aren't we? And we're not there. But we can look back in church history and be like, man, we can get there. They're getting there. Nothing's new under the sun. But we can continue to try to be the family that God wants us to be. Let's see. Moving on. Emails about that. Then, of course, you have heresy. People were constantly messing and twisting and what's true and what's not true. What should you believe? This was all new to everybody. What is true? What is real? We can't read. What does it say? I don't have a book. I heard there's one over there, but the Romans took it. Well, this guy's saying stuff. Listen to him. What is he talking about? Is that true? Did Jesus really say that? Anytime you want to know what God has spoken, you can literally pull out your phone, open your Bible app, and read it. Man, what a great time to be alive. Wasn't their time. So heresy was a constant struggle. Of course, even today, heresy is still a struggle, despite all that we have. How would you know what to believe? So you have all these challenges. You have the Jewish people calling them heretics, them calling each other heretics, pagans trying to figure out how to live, Jews trying to figure out how to live, the general populace around me hating me, the government sometimes coming after me. This was not an easy time to be alive. But it was the time the church grew the most throughout human history. At no point in human history did the church grow as much as it did during this season. Maybe except China right now, who's dealing with all this stuff, right? These are the seasons when Christianity grows the most, when it's up against, I think there's something about that, isn't there? Something about like the truth of Christianity shines the most when life isn't easy and perfect and we're not having it all together. When we're facing it, when we're trying to figure these things out, when we're forced to love each other, when we're forced to address issues, when I have to stand up and choose this, otherwise there's consequences, that seems to bring out the best in people in some ways. And maybe there's some hope for us. And maybe some of the crap that's happening in our world today is going to have some fruit in the end. And as Christians, we're going to have to look at ourselves and be like, well, who are we going to be, right? So how did they respond to these threats? And this will kind of set up our next class, the next 2 weeks. How did they respond to all this stuff happening? Some of the ways they responded have interesting consequences that we can talk about. And some of them you might hear and be like, I would love to spend literally a whole class period just in this section. I'm going to go through in 15 minutes. You're going to be done. So I'm going to go quick, but this there's a lot here. So I tried to summarize it. Here's the first thing they did. I think this is human nature. I don't think it's Christians, it's human nature. Whenever you have something that, like Christianity or something like it, begins to just blow up and this sort of grassroots movement, right? It seems like you always come to this place where you're like, this is great, but in charge here? Right? Like, do we just kind of let this thing keep going? Or do we, like, you know, should we create some boundaries? Should we put somebody? We need a manager, right? My career is kind of, I guess I'm kind of a manager. That's what I do for a living. So I can't be too bad at managing. And I think there's a place for managing. There's also problems with management, right? When you try to control something, what's the, you know, you can dampen it. But it's clear that one of their responses to the threats was to create what we would call a hierarchy. That's not the right button. Sorry, guys. Let me see. Okay, fix that. Small break. Talk to yourselves. English muffins and either English or muffins. Discuss. There we go. So the first thing they did was they built a hierarchy. And they started creating red tape. Praise Jesus. Essentially, they appointed overseers, a word that we translate today as bishop. You might hear bishop a lot, like in Catholic churches, they still use it, or some Lutheran groups. But bishop, or a person who's sort of over an area. Again, remember you had like small little house churches? Eventually they sort of said, okay, we got all these small house churches in Corinth. You be like the bishop of Corinth, and all the different house churches sort of report to you. And any of them that are being weird or getting out of hand, you can sort of be like, I'm the bishop here, stop doing that, right? And we'll appoint somebody bishop who is like really learned and knows Paul and Jesus' teachings well, so they can sort of occasionally, maybe they go to house and sort of instruct everybody, but they're kind of in charge of that area. And then we'll have one person over Corinth and one person over here, but we'll have one person that's over all of them in this whole part of it. And then we'll have one person that's over all of them, right? And pretty soon, you keep going up and up until you get to one person way at the top, and you put a funny hat on his head and call him Pope. So this is what they did. The bishops became overseers. They were given authority, which just means you're in charge, right? We trust you to interpret the scripture. This is what the Bible means. This is what it says. And to guard against heresy. So if there was a house church in my town that's teaching something weird, I could go, no, that is not the truth. I'm the bishop, right? And so you can sort of understand why they did this. It makes sense, this managerial system. Because when things are getting out of hand, nobody knows what to do. All these questions, hey, this person recanted their faith publicly and now they want to be a Christian again. Should we let them back in? I don't know. Ask the bishop, right? You know, we're reading this letter from Paul and he's talking about, I don't know what he's talking about. All Israel will be saved. What's going on there? I don't ask the bishop. So having some management can be helpful. It brought some control. It brought some strength. Of course, it also brought some, you know, hierarchy and red tape, and eventually brought its own problems. So while the church was very grassroots at the beginning, by the second century, it starts to kind of become this defined structure, this sort of strongly held system of bishops. And it was believed that, you know, they were sort of, the authority was passed down. So Peter prayed for somebody to be a bishop, and they all the way kind of thing. And what would sort of, we'll start to see happen, we'll talk about this more next week. What would end up happening was, really, the bigger the town, the more important the bishop, right? That's kind of what happened. Like, well, we're both bishops, but you're the bishop of Lakeside, and I'm the bishop of Santee. So shut your mouth, right? Oh, the bishop of San Diego's here, right? So in the end, the most important bishop ended up being in the most important town, which was the bishop of Rome, so they called him Pope. This whole system then became like it was an organization eventually. By the third century, you had a full-blown organization whereby the bishops knew each other, they reported to each other, they had people above them, and if you were under a bishop, if you serve under a bishop, if you respected a bishop's authority, you were part of the group, right? Like that's what made you part of the church. And so when they described this group of people now who had leaders and told you what to do, it was the whole group, the whole church was called Catholic, which means universal or everything. That's where we get the word Catholic today. If you didn't accept the bishop, if you said, no, I don't believe that bishop has any power, you were sort of pushed out, you were excommunicado, you weren't part of the real church. Of course, that would last for 1,500 years before Martin Luther, and then in some ways still happens today. So And again, we have to understand this sort of strong hierarchical style. How you feel about it kind of depends where you come from. And maybe if you have a Catholic background, maybe some of you are still Catholic. And they're like, well, yeah, of course. If you're an American and your whole system of government was founded on rebellion and no king, you're like, no, hierarchy. There's pros and cons to it. I would say some of it was necessary, but it led to problems, as we'll see as our class continues. But it does appear to have been a necessary time to have some sense of, like, who can answer these questions? Who's in charge here? So, it's one thing, though, to say that guy, that person, that position has authority, but you had all these crazy ideas floating around, and you had a lot of different texts floating around, right? So, you say, like, interpret scripture. Which scripture? Like 1 Corinthians or the Gospel of Mary Magdalene? Like, which one, right? How do I know what I should do? You had early church leaders like a guy named Marcion who thought the Old Testament was a different God and wouldn't have his followers read it. You only read the New Testament. Jesus is a different God. So this kind of stuff is happening. Christians were arguing over which books we should or shouldn't read. And remember, if a Roman guy knocks on my door and says, hey, give me all your texts or I'm going to feed the lions, and you're like, well, I've got a Gospel of Thomas here. Do I die for it? I don't want to die for it if it's not the word of God. If it is, okay, right? That's a big deal. What books are actually worth dying for? So what they did was they wanted to create a standard. These are the ones we all accept. The word standard in Greek comes from cane, like a sugar cane. Here's a certain length. It's like a foot for us, like your foot. And we got the word canon. Canon means standard. The canon, if you've heard that phrase, refers to the accepted authoritative books that we now call the Bible. There were originally two sets. You had the Gospels. As far as we can tell, because again, we don't have any writings up until this early 7th century. As far as we can tell, though, the four Gospel books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were always accepted by everybody. There were no arguments about those four. And when they were written, they were just sort of accepted. Books like the Gospels of Thomas, Gospel of Mary, those, that was like almost 100 years later, and it was generally not accepted. And then there were 10 to 13 other books that, as far as we can tell, everybody believed that Paul was inspired by God, and so all of Paul's letters were accepted. Sometimes they'd argue whether he wrote some of them, but if Paul wrote it, we all believe it. Then there were others that they weren't sure about, and they really fought over. The three they fought the most over were Hebrews, James, and Revelation, for obvious reasons. They had questions about James because of his style of writing. Hebrews they thought might be too Jewish. Of course, they eventually broadly accepted him. Now, I debated as I was preparing this class to how much do I talk about the process of forming. And I decided I taught the Bible last summer. I don't know if you were in that class where I spent a long time on this. I'm going to have to, I don't know, I'll tell you to listen to it when I record it. Sorry. But as I don't really have time to get into how they found the Bible or how they made the decision. I'll just say this. There is a narrative out there that says you had this council with a bunch of old guys who got together and said, oh, these are the books we'll pick to control people. That's silliness. There was a council a couple hundred years later. All the council did was say, these are obviously the ones we all read. Everyone agree? What about Revelation? Let's talk about it. But for the most part, by the 4th century, they had their Bible. The whole thing was pretty much by the 2nd century. About 100 years after Jesus, the average Christian knew which books were in, which ones weren't. No one was arguing or dying over the Gospel of Thomas, despite what Dan Brown might have said in the Vinci Code. But they had this basic, so having the canon said, if it's not in the canon or disagrees with the canon, don't believe it. So again, Paul talks about what Jews should do. Paul talks about what pagans should do. The canon tells us. Here's the answer, right? Which book should I die for? How should I treat the government? Well, here's Paul's letter to Rome. He says respect governing authorities. He also says this, right? So now that I have the canon, I can sort of stand on it. Now, this doesn't mean we all now agree. It just meant now we know what we're arguing about. Instead of just arguing about everything, it's like, okay, these are the accepted books. What do these mean? Now we're going to fight about that. But at least we know what we're arguing over, right? So the first response to the threat was to create kind of a hierarchy, organizations, and leadership. The second was to have an accepted, these are the ones we believe in God's word. And like I mentioned in the beginning, this wasn't like a moment in time. This was over the course of a couple hundred years. And then you had one more thing, two more things. The other thing was okay, we have the list of accepted scriptures, but most of us can't read. And we have a bishop who reads, but he's one guy, and we see him like every 4 months. Like, we still feel weird. So they took a step further, and what they did was they said, let's take, we have the Bible, we have our Bible, we have our leaders. Let's take the basic, most fundamental things that we believe that every Christian should accept, and let's put it in a way that they can remember. And they formed something where they created these memorable, quick, some statements that started with, I believe, or I think this to be true, in which in Greek is credo, and it'd be shorter to creed. So you heard the word creed. A creed is a short, memorable statement of faith. These were aimed at helping people who didn't have Bibles, right? And this would be, you know, church would do different ways. You got in the Middle Ages, they would do things like this by painting pictures on stained glass windows, right? Different ways to help illiterate people remember things. But creeds were summaries of the basic beliefs, the teachings that were passed down by the apostles, summarized in very clear, direct things. Oftentimes, statements that directly contradicted heresies that were being taught at the time. And they would use the creeds in their catechism when they were teaching people. Remember that idea of, like, if a new convert came in, they wanted to teach and train them before they were baptized? Because it was important to them. I don't want to do this too much. When you're constantly under threat, and people are constantly turning their back on their faith to save their own life, your decision whether or not to baptize somebody else becomes a weightier thing. You do not baptize someone. You don't dunk them in that water and hear them say, I commit my life to King Jesus, unless you have a feeling that they're actually going to live this out, right? That they're not going to go and recant their baptism when things get a little warm. So they want to make sure they knew the truth. Here's the creed. This is what you're, when you get baptized, here's what you're committing your life to, that you believe and accept. And actually the word credo, its root is to set your heart upon, to give your heart, to give your life to. In Sanskrit and then in Arabic, it actually is the word for faith. So they were saying, like, we're going to teach the basic truths before we baptize. And when you got baptized, and we have full writings out of what they'd say, they would say, do you renounce Satan and all other worldly allegiances? Do you swear your heart and set your mind to the fact that there is one God? And they would go through the creed, and you would say, credo, I do. And they would, I believe this, and they would baptize you. So the creeds were a way of, they would separate genuine belief from heresy in these kind of clear and concise ways for people that didn't have access to the whole Bible. And the creeds would then last for thousands of years. We still have them today. Up until the last probably 30 or 40 years, most churches continued to read the creeds regularly. We don't as much. I think we did it like 6 years ago. But what we call the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, is a basic statement of Christianity. So if you ever hear this phrase, you probably won't, but if you ever do, if you are a Nicene Orthodox Christian, that means you accept the basic creed statement of the faith. Almost all Protestants are Nicene Orthodox Christians. But we just don't say that because it's confusing. But that's 2,000 years of history going all the way back to teaching the basic things. And I'll just real quick, about a couple minutes, I'll just tell you. There were people at the time who were teaching that Jesus was not actually a real person. He was just kind of a spirit. And the creed said, no, we believe that Jesus is fully human. Of course, the Jews were saying, I don't care if you think he's a Messiah. He ain't God. We believe Jesus, fully God, fully man. The agnostics claimed, I love this. Agnostics believed that all matter or physical things were inherently evil. And that the only thing good about you is a spirit inside of you. And you're in a prison of this broken, sinful flesh, and what you need is the secret wisdom to escape this prison so your spirit can be in a higher realm of existence. And some of you are like, that sounds like Christianity, not real Christianity. It sounds like Christianity has been influenced by Platonism and Gnosticism. The Christians said, all things that God created, he created good, and he wants to restore them to be good. Earth and physical things, your body is not evil, it's good. It's broken. God wants to fix it. He doesn't want you to escape your physical body. He wants to resurrect your body into a perfect form it was meant to be in. So we see these things in the creed. It's what they talked about. It's what they wrestled with. And these were the things they were arguing over. And it took time, for sure. There was definitely arguments that Jesus isn't coming back. That's silly. He's gone. No, no. We believe he will return to judge the living and the dead. We believe in the Holy Catholic Church, which was a statement about we believe these bishops actually have authority and should listen to them. That would come back to be an issue for sure. When we talk about that next month. Martin Luther, you don't believe these bishops have authority? The creed says you should. What are you doing there? But it helped people see the main things. Last thing, I got 3 minutes. Along with the bishops, the scriptures, now the creeds, you also had other people who we didn't really know what to call them, so we gave them different names. They followed as one category. Church fathers and apologists. Some of these guys were bishops, but some of them were just thinkers, philosophers, writers. Along with the development of all this stuff, you had these mostly men who helped guide and lead the way through writing and philosophical arguments, engaging the culture, fighting for truth. You saw this by the second century and the third century, this becomes very popular. Instead of just these poor, lowly, peasant people, you now have intellectual, learned men standing up and speaking in the public square. Paul was the first, but people would follow his example. People who had education, who had means, say, wait a second, you're saying all these Christians are stupid idiots. Actually, I went to school with you. I'm smarter than you are, and I'm a Christian. Let me explain why. This word apologist is from the Greek apologia, which just means an argument or defense. If you heard the word apologetics, that just means I'm defending my faith. We did that class last summer. So at the beginning of the church, these guys become heroes of the faith because I don't know if you ever felt this. I did when I was younger. When I was new to the faith and I didn't know a lot, and I saw somebody like on TV or the internet or something sort of like stand up and defend the faith in a really logical, rational way, and I was like, oh, cool. I'm like, yeah, well, those guys, right? Like, if you're living the time and you're like, oh, you're a Christian, you're an idiot, your beliefs are dumb, and then you heard about Justin Martyr and his book of being passed around against heresy, or Clement Alexander, Tertullian, Irenaeus, these guys who were just brilliant thinkers who were beginning to wrestle with what was actually being said, who were addressing some of the issues people were saying. Justin Martyr came and said, you're treating Christians unfairly because you think we're idiots. Our beliefs are actually more intellectually sound than yours, and here's why. He argued that Christians could be loyal to the emperor without having to swear allegiance. He was the first to argue that you can be loyal to Jesus and the emperor. So stop killing us. We can be good citizens. That would set the stage for what would then happen, and it still happens today. These guys were talking, creating like sound theological defenses of things, helping people think deeply. So you kind of see this movement of this sort of grassroots, low-class people, no education, just moving by the power of the Spirit, working with each other, and suddenly after a couple of centuries, you now have like brilliant thinkers standing in public forums, talking to emperors, defending and explaining the truth, writing books that we still have today. I mean, so you can read Tertullian, Irenaeus, Clement Alexander, brilliant thinkers. We have all their writings. And a lot of what we believe today, the way that we think about Scripture, they were some of the first to interpret it that way and explain it. So you start to see this begin to form. Christianity actually begins to take on a strong intellectual side to it. Some people, including Tertullian, didn't like it. He once said, what does Jerusalem have to do with Athens? We don't need to get philosophy involved here. And Irenaeus is like, I'm just speaking to the people, man. We argue with each other. Again, Christians argue with each other? What? But my point, though, is you see the way that the Christian community is responding to their threats. They're creating a hierarchy. They're kind of creating a system, putting people in charge. They're establishing this is what we believe. They're teaching it to each other. And then they're beginning to even sort of push back a little bit and say, oh, you think we're stupid? Here, let me explain this to you. And if you ever get a chance, you know, Justin Martyr's book is like, he's got a few of them, but his main one, it's really interesting. Like, he addresses things that I still hear today. The things that people were attacking Christianity 2,000 years ago, he's giving defenses that I still, like, it's not new, right? It was going on back then. There's a whole section in his book where the guy's arguing was like, so wait a minute, you believe that when you die, you're going to be resurrected in a physical body. And again, so if you die and you disintegrate and a cow eats some of your ashes and some of your other ashes get thrown in the ocean, are they all going to magically come together? Right? Like that, this is a reason. And Martyr, Justin Martyr, like, responds to this. And of course, he was eventually martyred, so going to be. But anyway, that's not the point. The point is, we see that Christians begin to defend. And there was a lot to defend against. There was a lot of bad ideas and problems. So this is just the beginning. Right, we're just talking about the first couple centuries. What will now happen is Christianity, as it continues to grow, it moves from grassroots, low level, poverty, to the intellectual, to the hierarchy, to power, eventually to the throne itself. And we'll see next week that the emperor himself becomes a Christian. What happens when a grassroots movement that grows because of persecution becomes the dominant, powerful force in the world? What happens when intellectualism that's used to defend and say, hey, we're not stupid, becomes, look how smart I am. This then becomes the arc of Christianity. What we're going to see is some of the things that we think of as heresy. There are things that today we say, that's not true. You go back to the 5th century and it's like there were millions of people who believed that. And they started a war and fought each other for 90 years. Who won? The person that you believe and agree with now? When we get to church history, you're going to find some things that might even be like, oh, that kind of makes me uncomfortable. That's okay. That's part of the humility that should come from studying this stuff. That maybe there's some things we don't have all the answers. There's some things we can be gracious to her about. There's some times we have to recognize that the power and the rights that we often fight for and that many of us are fighting so hard for today, we saw the church fight for many times throughout history. And we saw how it ended every time. And maybe looking back should inform how we're living right now. Because it never ends well. This story, I love this first class. It's like, yes! And the next class is like, wait, what? But that's the beauty of church history. So through all of it, we're going to see that God is still good. And 2,000 years has been changing lives. He's bringing hope and healing. We're going to have to look at some of the dark stuff, some of the stuff, the mistakes we made. But in the mistakes, we also see the glory of God moving. We also see people loving and caring for each other. We see amazing acts of kindness and mercy. It's easy for a few bad things to rise to the surface and ignore all the great things that we'll see. So we're not just going to focus on bad things. We're going to see some amazing stuff happen too. But that's kind of the base. That's the beginning. So by the 3rd century, by the end of the 200s, you have a church that's starting to become more intellectual, more structured, some leaders. They have their Bible. They have their basic beliefs. And suddenly, this young up-and-comer who's trying to aim for the throne decides to paint a cross on his shield, thinking God told him to. And he wins and makes the whole Roman Empire Christian and upends everything. So that's what we're going to start next week with Constantine, 301. All right, that's all I got. Thanks for 802. That's not bad. It's not bad. If you have any questions about talk, I don't have anything else to do. I'll hang out. Otherwise, we'll see you next Tuesday night. Thanks.